Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 74.
Chowatar. That's Urdu.
So since our last podcast episode, we've seen three shows in about a week.
Yes, we have. And we started off with a classic that's been around for, what, 25
years? Yeah. And probably most of you have seen it, or at least a good portion of you have seen it.
Yes.
Can you guess? Drum roll, please. Did you get the pun, the drum roll?
Yeah.
Okay. We saw Stomp, which is a classic percussion show at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Manhattan. It's an off-Broadway show. Lindsay, how does it compare to when you saw it in, what, eighth grade?
You know, in eighth grade, I remember being very, like, struck by it because I couldn't believe it was a show that I was seeing in a way. It was, like, the same time as Blue Man Group and Sheer Madness and Stomp. I saw it all around the same age. As an adult, I was just like, wow, this is so loud. And
can you describe it for anybody who hasn't seen Stomp?
So it's an hour and 45 minutes, which feels like an hour and 45 minutes. And it's basically a show only with percussion. And they make beats, drumming beats through stuff you'd find on the streets of New York. So trash cans, brooms, trash, lighters, big bins, sinks. And I would say that it's very inventive of how they make the different sounds. Like, it was fun to see the different ideas that they, the director of the company, had at the time of creation to do, like, the lighting. The lighter act was probably the best, my favorite.
The lighter act, you mean, like, with, like, what you would use to light a cigarette or a candle with?
Yeah, like a Zippo.
A Zippo lighter.
Yeah, and everyone had two, and they were creating, like, not only sounds with, like, flicking the lighter on and off, but also, obviously, you could see the flames, so it was creating patterns, which I really liked. Everyone was very talented and it was very, very good. But, and, you know, it was a completely foreign audience. Like, almost no one spoke English in the audience, which was also interesting to see.
And there's no talking in the show, so quite easy to see if you don't speak English.
Quite easy, yes. You know, the thing that it lacked a little bit was because they had to focus so much on the beat that they were doing or the rhythm they were doing, the performance, like, their actual performance lacked because they were so focused on creating the rhythm. So, like, some people were good at it and could have fun with the audience, while others it was just like a dead face kind of. So, you know, those are things I notice now as, like, a 31-year-old versus, you know, a 12-year-old.
I thought one of the interesting just sort of parallels to the circus world is how the show is really structured the same way a traditional circus show would be structured, with acts and a show flow. And it's basically the broom act and then the trash can act and then the sink act. And you could totally reorder them the way you might reorder a circus show. So,
yeah, it's been around for so long and there's a reason why.
This is quite true. We also saw a show that's not brand new, but it's been around for maybe 6 months, playing in Times Square at a venue called the Paradise Club inside the Edition Hotel on 48th Street, I think.
Or 47th.
Or 47th Street. The show is put together by the House of Yes. Those of you who've been longtime podcast listeners will remember the House of Yes founders, Anya and Kay, from our second or third podcast episode ever. Our first one was just you and I talking. They're our first interview guests, yes, Anya and Kay. And, you know, it doesn't take place at the House of Yes. It takes place in a completely different space, which was kind of weird, to be honest, seeing a House of Yes show not at House of Yes.
Yeah. We were invited by one of the artists, which was awesome to see. And they have a great Straps act that the premise is kind of like they're drunk and they're kind of fighting. And then they go into the Straps, which is a great...
And two girls Straps act, which you don't often see.
Yeah. And I thought it was a great premise for the act, for a Straps act, two girls. It was great. You know, what's great about the House of Yes aesthetic is that it's kind of unpolished, which is why I think it works so well at the House of Yes in Bushwick. And it feels very, like, disheveled in a good way. And, like...
And DIY.
DIY. So, like, the artists and, like, the unpolishedness of the acts at the House of Yes is part of the charm of it. Seeing it at a very polished, like, trying to feel very uppity and
fancy,
fancy space didn't quite mesh well with, for me at least. I wish it was a little bit more polished. Is not the right word.
Either I wish the space was done by House of Yes, yeah, where they would have decorated it in the House of Yes style, or that the show had been more polished to fit the room. There, yes, was just a bit of a disconnect between the,
yeah,
two.
Yeah, because there were some strange choices. You know, I've actually been noticing this in a few shows recently. It's like trying to get this party vibe started. And I think it's really, I mean, we tried to do it in Slumber. It is a very hard thing to achieve. And it only works, I think, on certain nights and like with certain audiences.
And certain kinds of shows.
And certain kinds of shows. And I think when you're like, who's ready to party? You're automatically making the audience have to go to that level at the beginning of a show, which is maybe not the right choice. I think you can get there by the end because the show has happened, the audience has gone on the journey with you. But it, I mean, we did it in Slumber too at the beginning. It was like, party, you know, and I think like it's hard to get right into it. You know, one thing that really was a bit of a problem, which I don't, that kind of can lead into the next show that we saw, is the when it's immersive and when the performers are in the audience moving around. And I think I've seen it done really well where everyone feels very like practiced and rehearsed and knows how to deal with the audience. But I was sitting at a table and there's like a silks moment at the end of the show that, you know, happens over the audience, which is cool. But the way in which it was orchestrated, the guy helping her on the silks like ran into my chair and pushed me into a table and it actually like hurt. So I went, oh my God, ouch. Like I just couldn't even like keep it in because I just was rammed into a table. And to be fair, he did come over and like whisper me. He was like, sorry about that. You're going to want to lean back. And I was like, if I had just been told before, like, can we move your chair here and we'll move you back? You know, it would have been like not even an issue and I wouldn't have been in the way. But I think like if you're dealing with audiences, making sure that the path for the performers are clearly
marked
and they know how to interact with the audience and not hit an audience member would be good. Cause he hit me twice. So like, you know, there were good things about it. And there was like a cool meal before, which I couldn't eat cause I was, you know, gluten free, but Josh ate it.
I did. I enjoyed it. There was some good prosciutto, some kind of weird presentational aspects to the food, but overall I would say like solid House of Yes show. Honestly, I would first recommend people go see a show at House of Yes to understand the vibe, and then if they love it, go see, yeah, the Paradise Club. I think it's running to the end of the year, so if you are a House of Yes regular and you do want to go see it, now is your chance. So on Saturday we saw a show called The Daydreamers, which was essentially a dance piece done by a group called Shinsa, and Shinsa is a dance troupe choreographed by Bo Park. Bo Park is a South Korean choreographer who was in Slumber. She's amazing. She choreographs in a very similar style to what we work in, urban dance. She's originally from South Korea but moved to New York, so she's got a bit of that K-pop vibe going on and a bit of the New York vibe going on, mm-hmm, which sort of is a bit of a point of difference from the West Coast style that we tend to work in more often. This was her second show. We saw her first one last year. The theme of this one was really about Bo's life coming from South Korea to America. And, you know, I actually quite liked how she clued in the title Daydreamers into the performance of that it's sort of okay to daydream and wish for better things and think of the future, and mm-hmm, how that's a positive quality. And it had a bunch of great performers in it, including some upcoming Beyond Babel understudies. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Granted,
that was great.
You know, it was her second show ever. It was their second performance of their second show ever. So they were still working out the kinks of it a little bit. But just really great energy. Nice to see this dance developing more and more and more, mm-hmm, performance opportunities for it.
Mm-hmm. I shed a tear at the end. It was very nice. And, you know, it was immersive. So they were moving the audience around. Hence why I was kind of talking about that before. They're moving the audience around to like different rooms, but not different. It was like one big room that they sectioned off into different
areas. They turned it into like four areas, basically.
And so you'd go to the... But one thing I said at intermission, because I think with audience movement, you just have to be so specific, like at the Paradise Club show. Like you have to just be so specific in placement, where everything is happening and how you're moving the audience to accommodate that. And at first, the kids moving the audience around were saying, like, their first two rows sit. And then all of a sudden, it was every row. If you see someone behind you, sit down, which is basically every row except the last row. And I was like, if you can just keep it consistent, if you're in the front half of the audience, please sit. And then they started doing that. And it's, as an audience member, you just want to have very clear instructions because you don't know what's happening. You know, like, you're experiencing it for the first time. So, but it was an interesting way of seeing an immersive show that I hadn't seen before, I think, like, in that, just like kind of like moving the audience point of view rather than like going through rooms or through a building.
Yes, it felt new, although also quite regular. Hard to explain, honestly. But they just did 5 shows. I think you'll probably have to wait a year to see the next one.
Yeah.
But follow Shinsa on Instagram. They post loads of, you know, dance content as we do as well.
Yeah.
So those are the shows we saw. And there was just a topic I wanted to talk about a little bit today on our sort of preamble pre-show, which is to do with the state of funding of circus and shows in general in America. And we spoke a little bit to our guest later in the episode about this. And offline, I've spoken to a few different producers and previous guests about their take. But it comes down to, if you want to do shows these days, if you want to do the next stomp, if you want to do the next showcase like, you know, Shinsa and Bo just did, how on earth do you fund it in America? And it was on my mind because maybe 2 weeks ago, I went to this circus conference that was held in New York, all sort of talking about the state of funding and how bad it is and how wouldn't it be great if America had more government funding? And it just, it turned a little bit into a complaint-a-thon, which these things tend to do, of why isn't America better? Why doesn't America have more government funding? And just for those people who are so willing to say that every time we complain, there's just a few things I want to bring up. And I'm not saying that there shouldn't be government funding for the arts entirely, but it's not the solution to every problem, and certainly not in America. And it's only getting worse. Like, you'll listen to the episode with Cecil today, our guest, and she grew up in a time where government funding was pretty prevalent. And then sort of around the 80s, it really started to take a turn and disappear. And I would say by this point, it's pretty much gone. Part of the reason for that is because Americans have lost their appetite for government funding. The NEA, which is the National Endowments for the Arts, gives less money to arts projects than Kickstarter does every year, which is to say that people are just generous. You can find people online who will generously donate to your arts project more than the government will. And in defense of people who aren't pro NEA, because every artist I hear is always like, oh, the NEA should have more money. But part of me does wonder, like, if you're, it's a national organization, and if you're living in Texas, like, why are you necessarily funding a dance show that you might see in New York or vice versa? If you're, you know, if you make $100 that week and 50 cents of it goes to a show you'll never see in a city you don't live in, it's not really a benefit that you can get necessarily. Of course, if it's local, it's a little bit different, but the National Endowments for the Arts is a large national organization. And, you know, maybe the money that your taxes are going to pay for goes to a show you hate, and that money could be spent on something you think is spent better on. So I'm sympathetic to, you know, complaints about the NEA, but really what I want to talk about is how people can just fundraise in the current state and not be dependent on the government. And getting to my larger point, I read this book this week by Ken Davenport called How to Fundraise for the Arts or Anything, which I would strongly recommend to anybody who's interested in producing theater, producing dance, producing circus, producing music, because Ken really lays out a number of strategies for fundraising from rich people, which maybe people will go, ugh, that sounds icky and gross. And, you know, I assume most people have heard that America has this insane level of income inequality, which is, you know, probably not good. But what it does mean is that there are, I think, literally millions of millionaires in America who you could go and find and try to ask money for your project. Or when I say ask, you know, you're really asking them as an investor in many cases, or as a nonprofit. So if it's a nonprofit, that's a donation. And if it's a for-profit company, that's an investment. And
okay, I'm going to cut off your monologue.
Okay.
I've worked at so many nonprofit theater organizations, right? Where, like, obviously when I first started 10 years ago, the nonprofit funding from the government was much more prevalent than it is now. Like Time Warner would give a lot, and now that Time Warner was acquired by, I forget, AT&T or something, their funding dried up. So I get it's getting harder and harder, but I also think that some people just like don't know these people. Like, how do you even find these really rich, wealthy people? And an easier way is to like apply to grants, you know, where you're kind of, you can go online, you can apply for the grant. Hopefully you get a little.
I'm not anti-grant application. And many grants are given by foundations that are run by rich people. So many rich people set up foundations that you just go online, you look them up, you know, the Ford Foundation, you find out how to apply for it, and you apply and you can get money as a nonprofit, and that has nothing to do with government funding.
Well, then you should be specific, because if you're okay with, like, nonprofit funding.
I'm okay with nonprofit funding. I'm okay with either if you're a for-profit or a nonprofit. I'm just sick of going to these circus conferences and everybody saying, oh, I wish the government gave us more money to do our circus.
Well, when people complain about the lack of government funding in America, what do you think the core root of the complaint is?
I think it's just they see other countries they've often never been to, or if they have been to them, they've only been for a short period of time and go, oh, why can't we be like that? Mm-hmm. And what one of the other things I was talking to another producer this week about was, and I bring it up with Cecil, is are the places that have the best circus arts that way because they have government funding or because they have successful commercial circus businesses there? So, for example, is Montreal so successful because it has Cirque du Soleil there, mm-hmm. or because there's government funding? Granted, I'll give you, those of you who are shouting the podcast right now, I understand Cirque du Soleil got $1 million in seed funding from the government, but they've made billions without government funding.
Right, but I guess the argument would be, well, without the $1 million from the government, how could they have even gotten to the place that they are now? Which I agree with. I mean, like, if you can get $1 million from your government to start a circus company, like, I think I get your argument, but if in America, if we could get $1 million to start the next big Cirque du Soleil, but the American version of it, wouldn't that also then add into your, like, debate of this? Because I think if we'd have an amazing big company that would fund and help grow smaller ones.
Well, I think if you just gave $1 million to a random person to start a circus company in America, the odds of it ending up like Cirque du Soleil are very, very slim in general. Just the, like, whatever you want to count, the 1 in 5, 1 in 4 success ratio. But the greater thing I'm getting at is the reason I think people were willing to take risks and give money to Seven Fingers or give money to Cirque du Soleil or any new startup companies is because Cirque du Soleil had proven a market for it in a commercial sense.
But they still got government funding to start.
And going back to the point of, you know, Cirque du Soleil's commercial success led to more businesses, part of the reason that Broadway is, and New York is, this theater center of the world, same with London, is not because the government gives money to Broadway shows, it's because there's so much commercial investment in Broadway shows, and that also supports an ecosystem for nonprofits, where commercial producers are just giving cash to nonprofits to develop work. Mm-hmm. You know, and just going further back, it's not like Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey, or like before the, you know, real nonprofit started in the 1940s and 1950s were getting government money. Like in the heyday of circus being enormous, I know it's different, we don't live 200 years ago, still these weren't like government-funded organizations that made it big. These were commercial organizations that figured out a way either to be lean startups and then grow, or find a rich person or a company to invest in them. And I get it. Maybe you don't completely agree with me, but I think just sitting at these conferences and complaining about, man, I wish there was more government funding, is just not a good use of that time.
It definitely doesn't do anything. But complaining about anything, like, never gets you anywhere. So, like, I totally understand that. I also think, though, that the one distinction I think people need to make, because frankly there's no government funding for any of the arts, not just specifically circus. It's not just like we don't give to the circus.
Well, that's not literally true. Some arts organizations do get government funding.
Oh yeah, no, what I'm saying, it's not like there's a ton of it for other organizations. It's not like these nonprofit theaters are getting loads and loads of money. Like, I know I've worked for so many, they are not getting massive amount of money from the government.
Yeah, maybe they get $10,000 or $20,000 a year.
Yeah, and like the big ones maybe get like $100,000 over 3 years or something. And that's like a win. I also think that when people are complaining about the government funding in America, it's not necessarily, well, A, you have to be specific, because why is it just government funding? Is it like funding in general for nonprofits? Or is it like, what is it about government funding that they feel like is lacking, and why, if it was more robust, it would be greater? Because I do think there are actually a lot of avenues that you can go to raise your money. There are a lot of grants from private organizations, from trusts, from
other nonprofits.
Other nonprofits. So I think like that's a little confusing when you make the argument to me. Or not like confusing, but I would like to specify the one thing about, because in my head, I'm like, well, why are we focused on government funding? You know?
Like, well, I think in circus, we focus on it because we think in Canada and we think in France. And I think that's really it. Maybe Australia.
Yeah.
Oh, there's oodles and oodles of government funding. I just spoke to a German circus academic maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. She was telling me Germany's just like America. There's essentially no money for it. You cross the border, you go to France and you see it. And, you know, maybe we all wish we lived in France. And I know Americans who moved to France and Belgium and use that government funding. Yeah. But it's not necessarily like you go over there and you're going to see shows you love.
But I guess like what's the reason why you want it? Is the reason you want government funding to do a show one time? Because that to me is like kind of a waste. If it's like, I want government funding to start a company that could grow and create jobs and show a lot of people our art, that's different to me.
And just, I'm sorry, this government funding page, one thing that just drives me additionally crazy about it. If you were to make that pitch and you wanted the MTA, which runs the subway system in New York City, they're a government organization. They say, hey, we're looking for contractors. Please apply to like work on the MTA. That's not as employee. That's if you're an electrician and you have an electrics company, they'll hire your company to go and, you know, work on the MTA and they'll give out money. Or if you're a government contractor, you know, they'll pay commercial companies to make tanks. The government won't give money to commercial producers. They'll only give money to nonprofit arts, which doesn't make any sense to me. I get that nonprofits should have funding. This is not an anti-nonprofit thing. But why is it that in our specific sector, the government only gives to nonprofits, but in other sectors, they'll give to commercial companies?
Yeah, I don't know.
It just seems strange. And
especially when, like, you know, in New York, Broadway is what's raking in a lot of the profit for the city. Like, it is makes almost like, I forget the statistic, we should look it up, but it makes like, I forget how many millions and millions and millions of dollars.
And you know where all those, I would say probably over 50% of those millions and millions of dollars go?
Where?
To the Schubert Organization.
Yeah, which is a nonprofit organization that funds.
So the Schuberts, right, who own 20 plus theaters on Broadway, they're a commercial business owned by a nonprofit. So they make the money commercially, right, and then they give it out in these grants we're talking about.
But
afterwards,
to be fair, I think the complaining needs to just be more specific. Because to complain in the sense of, obviously we know there's not that much government funding for the arts. What we would like is to have the same opportunities to apply for the grants, the theatrical grants for circus shows. As theater, traditional theater shows, because I think that's the problem also. It's like a lot of these grants and nonprofits and government funding, you can only apply with a theater.
A nonprofit. And that takes like over a year. Even if you're like, hey, Josh, I'm just going to start a nonprofit. Great. It's going to take you a year from when you started to get it certified as a nonprofit. Right. And you have to jump through plenty of other hoops. Just the last thing I would say to this is, I just want these conversations to start turning towards reality a little bit. And maybe we spend the first 5 minutes of these conferences lamenting government, but then let's spend the next 55 minutes of our hour talking about what we can actually do and not the rest of that time saying, I wish we were like France. Anyways, on today's episode, we're going to be speaking with Cecil McKinnon. But before we do that, we got to give a shout out to our sponsors over at CircusTalk.com, the circus industry's number one resource for job information, events, and news. So a couple things that I noticed this week that I thought were particularly interesting, starting in the job section. Circus Mercus, my alma mater, is looking for a development manager and executive assistant. This person will be there to help Jen Carla, who's the executive director. Wonderful woman, strongly recommend this job for people who think that might be a good fit. Also, Theater Mama in Miami, Florida is looking for circus artists for a bunch of special events over the Christmas holiday season. So if you are a Floridian looking for some work, go over to Circus Talk to the jobs page and take a look at that. On their events page, They point out that the National Circus Festival of Ireland is happening from November 14th to the 17th. That looked pretty cool, actually, but I don't think we're going to make it over to Ireland. The application deadline for Codarts, which is a circus school in Holland, is coming up. How to apply for that school and that program, all the information's online on their website. And finally, my favorite part of the website is the news section, and we have a little bit of sad news this week. They had a wonderful obituary about the Circus Monty founder, Hildegard Muntweiler, who passed away a few weeks ago. For those who haven't seen it, Circus Monty is a beautiful, classical Swiss circus in a yellow and red tent. Wonderful show. I am sure she will be sorely missed within the Swiss circus community.
So on this week's episode, as we've talked about a few times already, we have Cecil McKinnon, who is our previous guest, Jack Marsh's mother. And she, as you'll hear, worked with the Pickle Family Circus. She worked with Flora. She's an established actress in New York. And she this year is working with Big Apple as the director with Jack. And she's a very interesting person. I had loads of fun talking to her, and I think you guys will enjoy it. And if you like our podcast, please make sure to rate us on iTunes, subscribe on iTunes, and you can Twitter tweet us or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. And if you have an argument against Josh
or Lindsay,
I think more people will be on my side. But maybe, who knows? Maybe everyone thinks we're crazy. You know, it's always fun to have a conversation like this and explore different ways of thinking about it. So if you have any ideas, like, email us. Here is our episode with Cecil.
Well, thank you so much for coming over and coming on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Would you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and where you're from?
Well, I'm from the Midwest. Came to New York as soon as I could, and I went to NYU to what is now the acting program at Tisch. And so that was...
Where in the Midwest?
From a combination of Chicago and Kentucky.
Did you know you wanted to do performing arts?
Yeah.
So it started when you were little.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people who stay in it for their whole lifetime, yeah, that's just what they do.
Was there a show or company you saw as a kid that made you be like, that's the thing?
Oh, I hardly ever saw any theater at that time. I mean, there was none anywhere near me. It's not like Chicago is now. And no, it's just I made my brothers and sisters rehearse with me or my neighborhood friends and put on shows. That's all I ever, you know, did as recreation. I remember at five or six, I don't know before that, but I always did that.
And when did this circus element start coming into your life, or was it always there?
No, I'd never been to a circus, I don't think. Just like I'd never been to the, I just had never been in too much of live theater. I was occasionally taken to a ballet or a symphony, those sorts of things, but that was about.
It's kind of nice though to not be inundated with like ideas that you, preconceived notions of what it should or shouldn't be.
I mean, right. We didn't have a TV. There just wasn't that much around for me at that time, which was fine. Mm-hmm. But so I don't know why. Well, except there's the tradition in the Midwest of family theatricals. It's quite common, or at least it used to be. And
what do you mean by family theatricals?
Well, like people put on pageants and people I knew did that with their families and invite friends over to come and see it. And it was sort of a, you know, sort of, they called it tableau vivant at one point, where it was like a painting brought to life, or, you know, this sort of thing used to go on. Or another, there's a town, I don't know why this all randomly, but there's a town in Tennessee I used to go through called Red Boiling Springs, and they did a town pageant every year about the founding of the town and the, you know, the whole history of the town, and the whole town was in it. There was basically almost no, you know, and so yeah, I think there's a strong tradition that way because, you know, my family, as my aunt says, we went to the wrong place at the wrong time for centuries. So sort of out in Kansas in the middle of nowhere, you know, there's like not a whole lot to do, so you entertain yourselves by putting together dramatic pieces in the living room.
So what gave you the confidence to move to New York? Yeah. That seems like quite a change.
I don't know. It was. Nobody thought it was a good idea, but I knew it was a good idea. I don't know why. I just was like, got here as soon as I could.
Was the appeal just the city or the ability to see theater and be part of that community?
The city theater, theater schools were just starting up kind of, and it was a stab in the dark. I knew nothing. It was just...
How big a class size was it when you started?
At
NYU?
At NYU. Well,
like your program.
What is now called grad acting was there then just anybody. Didn't matter what you were academically, but it was small, like 18 or 19.
Oh, wow.
Not a big... You got in by audition.
Mm-hmm. Wow, and you just got there and...
I don't know how that happened. I just auditioned.
Welcome to the big city. So is that a four-year program?
Oh, no. It was, well, it depends.
Yeah.
You could go there without a high school degree. You could go there with a college degree. You could. There's a whole mix of people at that time. It's gotten a little more formalized.
Yes, yes.
So once you were in school, did you just see yourself going a traditional kind of actor, play kind of route?
No, or? I was always interested in popular theater, in theater that would reach as many people as possible. And I think that's how Circus got into it. And Javi Burgess was teaching there. And,
oh, he was doing the juggling?
Yeah. Well, not just juggling. He taught tumbling,
he did tight wire,
right. Trapeze. And we, when we were still in school, formed a troupe with him. And we had a studio on the Bowery and performed in the park. And... did fairly well, you know, made money, which was important. And then from that, a couple of people in that who I don't think were at NYU, but anyway, they went out to the San Francisco Mime Troupe and taught them to juggle and got involved there. And then after that, I was still in touch with them and I was doing a show that was very long running here. And the Mime Troupe came, they were doing a show that was very long running. So we would meet after shows or in between shows and juggle and do stuff, you know, and all night. Sometimes we would juggle, we would work all night. So that was how I, through the Mime Troupe, I met Larry and Peggy and we started the Pickle Family Circus on the West Coast. Well, first we were the Pickle Family Jugglers and we traveled around. And Gypsy, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Also previous guest.
Yeah. Previous
guest. Let's see.
And Lorenzo.
Lorenzo, of course. But before Lorenzo was born, Gypsy traveled. We had a small Dodge van, which overheated all the time. And Peggy, who could do anything, rebuilt the top with our help. Fiberglass top. And made a bed up there and a bed in the front for Gyp and me. So we all could fit in this Dodge van.
Oh my God.
Traveled across country.
By that point, had you been seeing other circuses or were you still?
Oh, yeah. Because by then we were booked into circuses and we'd done a little bit of TV. And by that time I'd been doing theater too. And then that they wanted to expand to the circus. I was like, let's just keep traveling this truck. We don't need to expand. But they expanded. And put an ad in the paper, and circus performers, and Bill Irwin answered that ad. So that's how he joined it, and it was kind of just like that.
Natural growth.
The story of the Pickle Family Circus is just amazing.
But you seem to be one of these few people who sit in this sort of junction between theater and circus throughout your career.
Yeah, I have gone back and forth always.
And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to something that we've noticed, which is just the difference in culture, that with circus people, there seems to be a very... self-starter, DIY, take care of yourself kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. I think in part because you're always on to the next show and it's always about your act.
Mm-hmm.
While with theater, there's much more structure. You have a stage manager who has a clear role. You have a production mm-hmm. manager, you have a mm-hmm. director, you have a playwright. And circus doesn't really have those things right. always in the same way.
Right.
How do you see the differences between the two forms?
Well, at a certain point, I did a great deal of Shakespeare with Shakespeare and Company. And I think Shakespeare is very much like circus. Like there's, you know, there's the threads of comedy and serious things that going through. And I'm not sure I know he didn't have a stage manager. You know, it was like, oh no. Okay, you go. Okay, I'll go. I think theater actually, and it certainly does, come from the same roots. Like in the 19th century, theaters were places people shouted and carried on, you know, as in Shakespeare's time. Then there was a sort of decision made sometime in the 19th that everybody should be quiet and pay absolute strict attention and behave themselves in a sort of more middle class or upper class way mm-hmm. than a popular form. So that's maybe when they diverged, although the clowns have always gone back and forth between yeah. circus and theater, you know, basically.
We were reading, I want to find this article because it was so interesting in one of our classes at Columbia a while ago. It was like the history of theater, basically. Uh-huh. But it was talking about the start of circus and really how it was like the everyman's art form
right.
and how it felt like very attainable and achievable for everyone to go.
Yeah.
And then theater was like that too. And then it just became not.
And theater diverged from it.
Yeah. But circus yeah. still feels, I mean, not I all so. Circus.
Well,
but
that's why I do circus. Yeah. I want it to be not just for the few friends of mine who have, right. but for a bigger audience, a wider audience, an audience of people I don't necessarily know or agree with. Mm-hmm. You know, I want, that's who it should be for.
Yeah.
So you bounced from New York to San Francisco.
Right.
Were you just ready to move to California out of the New York theater scene and join a little circuit, upstart circus?
No, I think the sequence was, I mean, we were doing that. I was, you know, we were traveling with our, as the Pickle Family Jugglers. And then
where did the name Pickle Family Jugglers come from?
We were doing a TV show. Someone met us in the park and said, come to ABC, I think it was, which is a big building in Midtown. And the downstairs desk said, who shall I say? And meanwhile, this vaudevillian guy had been saying, you know, K's are funny. P's and K's are funny. L's are not funny, you know. So we said, the Pickles. And this, you know, as a joke. You yeah. know, and this receptionist goes, the Pickles are here. We just thought it was so funny.
Oh my God, that stayed
the
so
name.
Funny.
We just kept the name.
The Pickles.
Because there's a funny word that was really sure. all. You know, it had yes. nothing to do with anything.
Right.
Like most of life was random.
Sorry, I cut you off. So you were going with the Pickle Family Jugglers.
Jugglers, yes, that was us. And what was the question?
Basically now? That transition from New York to San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
And
well, so Peggy and Larry were based in San Francisco, and I was based in New York. So it was a constant going back and forth, sometimes driving cross country, some, you know. And at a certain point, I thought, well, what I should do, and the show I was doing here closed, what I should do is go out west and see if I can, you know, combine, go to L.A., and then I can get, San Francisco's a lot closer than New York. Mm-hmm. So I did a little bit of TV, and I was commuting up to San Francisco, and that is actually a longer, it's really not close by.
No.
It's not like Boston, New York.
No,
at all,
no.
You know, it's far. So then I got a job at ACT, which is the regional theater, and that sort of combined things. And the Pickle Family Circus had started then, so I could make a steady living.
What was your favorite show that you were in New York?
Favorite. I don't know, because at different times, I still adore Mack Wellman, and I was mm-hmm. in an early Mack Wellman play, mm-hmm. and I just think he's a fantastic writer.
He is.
Christopher Marlowe's Faustus I really liked. So it was like a really wide
yeah.
range of
yeah.
random things.
Yeah.
Did improv too sometimes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Although in those days it was a different scene, but
right.
you know, not huge.
Right. Now everyone can do improv.
Everybody does it.
Whether they should or not.
So, you know, from my understanding of the Pickle Family history, it sort of just grew and grew until it sort of evolved, and there was new management that took over it after a while.
Well, it was at that time we did everything communally.
Yeah.
And so it was a communally run. I think there were 9 or 10 people or something running it. And then we'd bring in other acts, but it was basically a nucleus of people. And I can't remember. It's funny how it was all very fraught, but I can't remember the exact reasons why it shifted. One of them was that the Larry, Jeff Hoyle, do you know Jeff? And Bill all wanted to do solo shows, mm. and others of us weren't as interested. So it kind of, that group of people kind of went off in different directions. And so other people, and it turned into an indoor show. That was after I'd left.
Yeah.
And I'd had my first child by then. And so it evolved into a different show naturally because different people were running it. And
when you were in the show, did you mainly juggle?
Yeah, I did juggling and acrobatics.
Oh, yeah. What acrobatic? Like just floor?
Just floor, like you know, walkovers. And, we would do like the movers are here. And so the moving company would come in and they'd mishandle things and throw things and dive over things and, you know, like that.
Oh, fun. And,
things like that.
You know, you don't really come across all that many female jugglers, and not so much in a sexist way, but it tends to appeal more
it
to
used
like
to be,
you know,
yeah, it used to be almost all men. It hurts your hands a lot.
Yeah.
But Peggy and I had a great time with it.
We saw Big Apple, which you directed this year. I remember watching the juggling act, which is done by Kyle Drakes. And then he goes, oh, rings look like the best thing to juggle. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure they're the most painful
thing
to juggle.
They are really painful. Yeah.
Well, it's like you just have so much to grab.
Yeah, it looks like that, but they actually hit. They are very painful.
That's what Josh said. He goes, no, Lindsay, they're very painful.
Very painful. Yeah. I mean, you get so it doesn't hurt because then, you know, like
calluses and stuff.
Oh yeah, just the nerves.
Well, when we first started dating, Josh was like, if you are going to be a part of the circus, you need to try something and know how hard it is. And I was like, okay. And of course we did flying trapeze or swinging trapeze. I didn't leave the trapeze,
right.
But my hands killed. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it did actually give me such appreciation for every single thing that I watched now, you know?
Yeah. And your knees, if you're on a trapeze, or your ankles.
Everything. I had to get 2 cups of coffee to like ice my hand. It was horrible. It was very hard.
It looks painful. It probably is.
Yeah.
So after finishing up with the Pickle Family,
yes,
what were you interested in? Like, did you be like, I want to do more theater, I want to do more circus?
Yeah,
where was your mind?
I came back to New York really to do theater. It's sort of the all the people that I was most connected to with Pickle Family were leaving, and I came back to New York with my husband and baby, and the Shakespeare and Company was starting at just about the same time. So I went up there and did Shakespeare for a long time. But ironically, the first year I was up there, there was a woman practicing vaulting in the sort of field. And I was up very early with this baby who was, you know, like all babies, or most babies, likes early morning hours, and actors do not like early morning. We're living communally, so I would go for infinitely long walks for like hours. And exhausted walking along. But this woman was vaulting, and I knew a little bit about it because we worked state fairs and county fairs as a juggling act. So I would keep up the horse. I'd put the baby on my back and keep up the horse for her. And her name's Anouk. And she, have you met Anouk?
No, but I know who she is.
You know who she is. So she's a wonderful woman. And we became friends. And at the end of that season, I gave her an introduction to Paul Binder at the Big Apple. And she came down and met David Balding, who was the producer for Big Apple at that time. And they splintered off from Big Apple and founded Circus Flora and contacted me. And I had never thought I would do circus again, but they were starting at the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina. And I thought, oh, that would be fun. And I just had my second kid. And
Jack.
Yeah.
Previous podcast.
Also previous podcast.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm connected to all your podcasts.
I know. You really are.
The grandmother of all your podcasts. Anyway, so we went to the Spoleto Festival, which was indeed really fun. And the circus was set up in Marion Square, which is the main square in the middle of the city. It was great.
Did you have, like, when I did acting, Shakespeare was very, very hard for me. Like, I went to a program in London to try to get better. I don't know how I got in, but I got in. And I just was, like, so bad at it. Uh-huh. Like, my professor was like, Shakey would be rolling in his grave. And did you have training, or did it just come naturally to you?
No, I'd done, in acting school, I'd done a little bit. But it was daunting, sure, especially coming from where I come from. But Shakespeare and Company has a whole training system, and by that time I had done that a lot and taught voice, and you have to do a lot of things to make a living, especially if you start having children. So I was doing all these things to try to make a living. And
like dialect voice coaching or singing?
Not singing. Voice, which is not really dialect. It's how the speaking voice is in theater and therefore connected a lot to Shakespeare often.
Yeah. Yeah, I use a lot of breath control with Shakespeare.
Yeah, that, but also thought.
Yeah.
And so that, I did a lot of training in that and worked on it for a long time and really got to love it. I didn't love it at first. I still can't read a Shakespeare play.
I know it's so much better to see.
Meant to be listened to, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
But for, you know, we have a lot of young people who listen to the podcast. Uh-huh. Is there a particular Shakespeare play or show, other than maybe Romeo and Juliet,
right,
other than the big hits, that you would recommend if it's on in their town? Or
oh, yeah, like Comedy of Errors.
Oh, yeah.
You know that one, which is, he first wrote really, you know, like Commedia scenarios, that and Love's Labour's Lost, which is got a Pantalone and a Brigitte, you know, it has the characters of those early ones of his.
Of the Commedia dell'arte characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're in Love's Labour's and Comedy of Errors too. In particular, I think, of course, Midsummer, but it's...
You're drawn more to the comedy side.
Oh, I've always really liked and been very interested in women and comedy, you know, for forever, you know, because it's a fascinating topic. You know, it's not really funny to hit a woman.
Right, right.
Whereas hitting a man is funny, you know, or, you know, in that kind of thing, but... it's just not quite as funny.
It's funny often for a woman to hit a man, depending on the
depending on the circumstances. But, you know, it's
true.
It's, you know, it's, you have to take it in. It's like, you know, it's not the same. And and it's not that women aren't funny, but you have to find its own way, you know.
Yeah, and find the own sort of game that you can play with that.
Yeah, and also within your time of how you want to present women and how you think what you want that to be, you know, like in circus too. You know, I think that's changed a whole lot in over the years. I mean, how women are presented in circus.
Mm. In what way do you think it's changed?
It used to be women were a complete adornment and, on the whole, not always. A lot of old circus families, the women have always had powerful positions, but there's always been, you know, the sort of lovely assistant of the male person who does the act. That's the most traditional thing you see or used to see.
Yeah, very typical of maybe a juggling act where you have that just
ball here.
And she's looking scantily clad and, you know, and he's fully dressed. Yeah, that's the typical, you know, I think we've gotten away from that, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, jumping back to Circus Flora and the origins of that. So you moved to St. Louis, correct?
No, I never moved to St. Louis.
No.
No. Circus Flora started in South Carolina at the Split Up Festival. And then we were touring all over the place. And we stopped in St. Louis. And we were looking for somewhere to... We had an elephant and a lot of horses. Somewhere for them to go for, I think, 3 weeks. And someone in St. Louis said... Well, first the mayor offered us some land. And then someone else said, well, there's this woman who has a farm out just outside of St. Louis. Perhaps she likes animals, perhaps. You know, so we met her and went to stay there. And David fell in love with her and married her, and the circus stayed there.
Oh, that's so funny. That's how that happened.
Yeah, that's how it happened.
Oh, my. I always just thought it originated in St. Louis.
No. That's hilarious. David wasn't from St. Louis.
Oh, my gosh.
No, it all happened. And one day I saw them kissing. I thought,
that's why we're here.
I see. What's happening?
That's why we're not leaving.
Well, certainly one of the things that's changed over the last couple of decades is animals in circus.
Yeah.
And, you know, you wouldn't, many states, including New York and California, don't even let you bring an elephant into the show anymore.
Right.
What are your just general feelings on that?
Oh, I feel really sad about it. I mean, I think you have a cat. Love between species is one of the enriching parts of life. And circus animals are very well loved. To me, PETA has won that publicity campaign, hands down. And that's really too bad. of course, there are mistreated animals. There are also mistreated children.
And people in general.
And people. You know, there's some people shouldn't be parents. Mm-hmm. And some people shouldn't be training animals. I think you, in the circus business, you quickly get to know who those people are and you don't hire them just from the way that you just see you it see in it. The ring or you see it backstage. Anyway, I think it's a huge loss. And I'm afraid it's going to be an enormous loss for all of us when there are no more elephants.
You know, I know.
Because they can't survive. They're huge vegetarians.
Mm-hmm. No. And one of the things that people sort of the PETA arm argument is like, oh, you know, it's so unnatural to have these animals working with people. They should be out in the wild. And in my mind, at least with elephants, I'm like, haven't we had a symbiotic relationship with elephants all over the world for thousands of years?
Well, Asians is thousands of years. Africans
the mahouts and their elephants. Yeah. I mean, and also, you know, I went to an elephant sanctuary in Africa. Mm-hmm. And it's basically baby elephants that they save because their moms have been killed by poachers. Yeah. Yeah. And they can't really be released to the wild. They try, but they don't know how really to survive. Yeah. And like their entire lives are with humans, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's who takes care of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem. Like, that's how Circus Flora got Flora. She was orphaned. Someone shot her mother. Mm-hmm. And it's like a human. I mean, they're not going to survive.
Right.
And so she was adopted. And at that time, it was considered, you know, like it now is to take in rescue dogs. You know,
right.
At that time, it was like rescuing. Now it's not considered a good thing to do at all. But and maybe that's right. I just don't know.
Yeah.
But Flora, you know, grew up with people and
Flora's the name of the elephant.
Yeah, she's the name of the elephant. Yeah. After Babar and, you know.
Oh, cute.
There's a Flora in that story.
And the circus is named after her, right?
Yeah. She was one and a half when we started. Yeah.
Oh. My gosh. How did he get her?
Well, David's family were horse trainers.
Uh-huh.
Or are. I mean, very exalted horse trainers, like the horse trainers to the Queen of England.
Oh, wow.
The Whitneys. You know, they're really, I don't know how you describe that kind of horse trainer.
Fancy horse trainer.
And very well known as horse trainers. And David had apprenticed with the Chipperfields, which was a circus in London, in England. And so the sort of animal circus world, which is pretty small, mm-hmm. knew him. And someone just contacted him. I guess knew he was starting a circus. And I don't know. And David has died, so I can't ask him the exact sequence. But he had just gotten Flora maybe 4 or 5 months before I met him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the growth of Flora from when you joined to what it is today?
The shows? The circus Flora?
Yeah, the shows.
The growth. She grew very
soon.
Yeah, she's
Well, yeah, it started very deliberately as a theatrical circus and still is. It was, as I said, in Charleston, and then it was quite a success there, so we toured it, and it was kind of, David came from a large family, his sister would help book, and it was kind of like we're all employees of the family, so that finally expanded beyond that, so it had a staff. And it toured quite a bit. And then at the time of, I think it was like 2008, 2009 with that recession, when mm-hmm. we lost the kind of corporate funding we'd had, like people would bring us to someplace, and that just disappeared. So it really hasn't toured since then, since maybe 2009 or 2010.
Well, so let's continue to tour.
What?
It was continuing to tour up until
then. It was until then, but it just, it lost its bookings, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was a nonprofit, and, or is a nonprofit, I guess. I can't remember the status right now, but I think it was very hard for a lot of circuses at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was when Big Apple started to have problems as well.
Yeah, right.
When you say theatrical circus, what does that mean to you?
It means it had a narrative and it had sort of like narrative enfolded the acts. So they're part of the, it had a writer at that time. So that's what it meant.
Do you feel like you can do a narrative with circus without text, or text is sort of required to make a narrative work?
That's a good question. I don't know. You can do sort of a narrative, like a dream kind of narrative, I think. I've always done it with text, whether it's poetry or to bind the world together. But that's it. I don't know. Certainly with music and image, you could definitely do it, a narrative.
Is there a difference between working with actors and circus performers when it comes to telling a narrative, or having them be a particular character in a world you're trying to create?
Yeah, I mean, I there's not much crossover between actors and circus performers in my experience. It's quite a different way to perform, and it's quite a larger venue, unless it's on a stage. But if you're in circus with tents and things, it's big, and it has a demand to it of rhythm. And circus performers also aren't actors. Speaking without a task is really hard, and circus performers generally do best when they have a task, whatever their specialty is, or another couple of things. But, physically what they're doing, then they are electric and charismatic, I think.
And in addition to directing the shows, you're also often in them.
Yeah, I do a white-faced clown.
So can you talk a little bit about the tradition of the white-faced clown and where that comes from?
It comes from, my white face is from a painting in the 19th century, which is a traditional, you have a white cone hat, the most traditional is big blue velvet suit, and completely white face and one eyebrow, red under the nose and red ears. And that, if you're in Europe, you see that a lot in circuses. Mm-hmm. And that comes from before electric lights. A lot of theater and circus was done in white face, so you could see. Because it pulls your features out and you can see it. I think that's probably the same with mime. I don't know much about the history of mime. Mm. So when we started Circus Flora, that was what I was asked to create a white face, and I didn't really know how to do it, but it's an authority clown. It's a clown who speaks often and who also plays authority. It's not usually the one who falls over.
It's sort of the straight man, kind of.
Yeah, kind of, or the one you get around.
Yes.
So my image of it, for me, was Louis XIV, who thinks that the sun is me, and that everything I do is right, and I know everything. And now we know lots of people like that, but at the time, that kind of character who thinks a great deal of themselves. I mean, I think that's a funny person. If that funny person is not in charge of the world, and it gives room for the other clowns to see the absurdity of that person and get around them, which is helpful.
Have you seen Hamilton?
Yeah.
The king character is pretty, it's kind of like
the 14th character.
I mean, I guess that's using it in a,
I think that's actually George.
George
the third.
But he does that. Right. He's like, I'm important. And
I'm
then
very, very important. And you are not.
Yeah.
I think that's a great strain of comedy.
Yeah.
Is these. Well, and it's where a lot of circus and theater both come from, is making fun of the hierarchy, of the structure, whether it's religion or government. Whatever, it's just to turn it over and go, those
so we can laugh about something.
Yeah, so one day a year, you can laugh at these people the rest of the time.
In the theater.
So this year, you're directing the Big Apple Circus.
Yes.
Obviously, you've known and been around the Big Apple Circus since its creation.
Yeah, because I've lived in New York.
Did you ever think you'd end up directing it?
No, that was just out of nowhere. That was completely random. Randy Weiner.
Yeah. He's also another podcast guest.
And Josh's old boss.
There you go. So he came to St. Louis, and I'd never met him. And it was a really hot day, and I was in makeup between shows. And so we sat and talked in my trailer for a long time. And I really liked him. Very few people to talk circus with in the world. So that was great. And then it was after that that he contacted me. They contacted me about that. But Jack had been working there a couple of months before that. I think in April he started. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you are able to pull sort of some of the original thoughts that existed in the beginning back into Big Apple since you've been there for a while versus, just to preface this question, I would say at least since I started seeing it in 2006, they often would pick a director who had just done operas or just done plays and had no circus experience whatsoever. And you're sort of coming at it with an angle with a lot of circus experience.
Right. I mean, one way or another, at this point, I have a lot of experience. But, well, I don't know. It's every show is its own animal. And at the beginning of this show, I was thinking of, you know, of recreating but changing the show I'd been doing in St. Louis. That's where it started. It's completely changed.
Was it based on a hotel?
No, that was the show before. This one was at a grocery store.
Oh, a grocery store.
It was about this lost mineral that allowed people to fly. Oh. Aurorium that was hidden in the anchovies. Oh, nice. At the bottom of the lake.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, cute.
Yeah, it was very funny, and I really liked that. But it needed to move to New York. And in St. Louis, there's this grocery store called Schnucks, which in itself is a funny name.
Yes.
And sure. It is everywhere. Everyone in St. Louis has been to a Schnucks. And we don't have quite that.
No.
You know, there's D'Agostino's, there's this, there's that. But we don't have that same, like...
Fairway.
Yeah, Fairway, you know, World Market, whatever.
None of those have funny names on it.
No.
Names, and also not a place that every neighborhood has been, you know.
Yeah.
Every echelon of society has been to. So... that kind of morphed away, and the anchovies left. And I like the anchovies. They left us. And so, yeah, it just... And it was some acts that we'd had, that I'd known at Circus Floor and brought in, and then some acts that were already booked. So it was also a combination of factors that just... so it's... now it feels like to me like it's where it wants to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so we talked about that actually on the past episode because we saw Big Apple now a week and a half ago. Uh-huh. And I thought finally they were heading back in the direction of really quality circus acts.
Oh, like, the acts are great.
The acts this year are way better than the last 5, 6, 7 years. Like really excellent acts. Yeah. But also seems like a rigging nightmare in there.
Well, it is, you know, we put up the tent and do the show in New Jersey. We couldn't get that trapeze act up. Mostly because...
the finale act?
Yeah, the alias. Because of the fire marshals, really, because of the
guy wires.
Guy wires were going into, across the upper aisle. So we had to be all rethought, and literally rethought for here. And, Ali Sher is an engineer, which you... engineering classes should come to the show just to look what he created there.
Wow.
Because it moves to 4 different positions.
During the act.
It's insane, yeah.
You know,
it's all choreographed. And even like the cranking of the releasing of the wires just feels like, oh, great. Like this is like building suspension.
Yeah,
you know,
and you're watching the whole thing move. It's really moving to me to see this 9 people moving, and then all the other performers are cranking. They're the ones doing the work to get them up. It's a real company
effort.
Well, what we also were talking about this year was it felt like there wasn't so much a theme. It was more like New York, which was kind of refreshing, I would say, you know. It was just like really focused on the show and the acts and, you know, Amy G as the pigeon. But I said this on the last episode, but when she's like, get it together, Pidge. But when she said it the first time, I thought she said a swear word. And I was like, wow, we're going risque. I'm like, get it, you got a pitch. And I was like, and then she said it a few more times. I understood what she said, but I was like, oh my God. Wow. Putting in some adult language. But was that always the, I mean, obviously the intention at first was to bring the theme of the grocery store. Yeah. But at what point did you switch to just kind of really focusing on
New York?
Yeah.
Sometime in August. Yeah, this all happened very quickly. So it was really in August that Jack and I write these shows together. So we're rewriting it. And I think it was in there that the grocery store thing left. And with it, the grocery store then had to go to the anchovies. And, because it didn't make, you know, why would you be talking about anchovies if you weren't in the grocery store? And then it was a New York, like, street corner. But then that seemed like no reason it should be so specific to one place. Mm-hmm. But it was very important to us that it feel like New York, mm-hmm. like it include all of New York. And that, and that is what felt right. You mm-hmm. know? I mean, in making sure you have ideas and then it doesn't feel right, so you shift. Mm-hmm. And Storm is an amazing singer, so that is what took us in that direction.
Yeah, the ringmaster.
Yeah, the ringmaster.
We saw her in Company XIV.
Yes, I did.
A very different feel.
Very different show.
More, less family friendly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but she was great. It was nice to have the singing and, you know, like, Amy G doing a mashup of, like, all, like, flying references, songs and stuff. It was nice to have... to have singing, you know.
I'm on the ledge.
Oh, yeah. Which I'm on the ledge.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to see the show to know what we're talking about. For that
you have to go see Big Apple.
Yeah, actually, we're just reworking that medley. But...
Oh, okay.
Well, go quick then.
No, it's in. That's just, we're changing it. Because
I'm on the ledge.
We changed the show quite a bit.
Oh, really? We'll have to go back.
So one of your other gigs is teaching at ETW at, and are you still at ETW?
No.
Oh, not anymore.
No,
you quit.
I'm not there anymore.
Oh,
I
never mind.
2 years ago, but I taught there forever, so you can ask me about ETW.
Okay, great.
Did you teach Spencer Novick?
I did.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yes.
That's
where he is our very good friend, was in our wedding.
Oh. Yeah.
Yes, way back in the Circus Marcus days.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of circusy clowny people that have come out of ETW.
Right.
And often when people ask me about NYU's, like, Tisch acting programs, it should be Atlantic or Stella Adler. Mm-hmm. I'm always like, all the cool kids came out of ETW. but they're also all, like, in the hallway, like, on all fours, like, barking like dogs and weird animals, you know, doing...
Well, most of NYU thinks they just always take their clothes off.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if you could talk about just that program a little bit and the way in which... this is the kinds of trainings that you think is good for actors and performers in general.
Well, I think ETW has like some of the better dance minds at the moment in New York tend to be teaching there or coming through there, and that's so for it brings movement in very strongly. Mm-hmm. And I teach voice very much with movement, and so there and they teach acting with movement, sort of coming out of the. Grotowski, do you know who that is?
Don't.
He's an acting theory. Very physical.
Okay.
And that's part of it. So I think that's part of why ETW is what it is, because this very physically based acting program. Mm-hmm. So people like Spencer, who I don't know that he would have known where he was going when he started, that's kind of, he went off there and we've been trying to, We constantly talking to him about trying to do something with him.
Oh my God.
He's too busy.
He's too busy doing the same show, Blanc to Blanc, which we saw in Australia and we just saw in Vegas.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's always just
he's busy.
Amazing.
But don't give up. He has an apartment in New York City. He should, Spencer, you should move here and come back. Off the road.
Spencer. I know. Spencer's incredible. I mean, we recreated his sound effects act with him with the... intention of it being like bullying at school and kind of overcoming that. And
he would be very good for that.
It That's was so idea. Good. Yeah. He performed it. We never, the show never came to fruition, but it was like the most amazing I've ever seen him do that act because it had comedy, but it also had a lot of feeling and like overcoming something, which was, I mean, I hope we can see him do that act like live sometime because it was so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So so you taught at the school. And what was your class called?
Voice.
Okay, voice.
Voice class. Yeah. And in most acting schools have a movement class, a voice class, mm-hmm. and acting class, and maybe improv.
See, my musical theater, I was, voices mm-hmm. to me is just always singing.
Yeah, no, speaking voice for, it's like an acting class, but it's working on, basically, hopefully you're going to be in the theater for your lifetime, and so your voice is pretty mm-hmm. crucial, and how do you use it, maintain it, keep it exercised, mm-hmm. and have it work for you no matter how you feel.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I've really just always come from a musical theater background, uh-huh. not uh-huh. purely just acting. So I would always like warm up my voice like a singer would, right. but I never.
You have to warm up as a, you know.
Yeah, as an actor, yeah, I just, of course.
People like, do it all the time and usually have some regimen of or other that
ha,
they follow.
Ha, 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 ha. I know, I talk loud uh-huh. sometimes. I'm like, sorry, I just learned to project in the theater. Because our theater in school did not have mics. Uh-huh.
Just yeah, most of them don't.
Yeah, old school.
Old school.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when did you leave, you said?
I think it was 2 years ago.
So what's NYU going to do without you and Javi?
Oh, I don't know.
I know. Javi's also a podcast guest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Javi's very happily ensconced in burlesque.
So yes.
He makes a cameo in
The
Big Apple.
Yeah, right.
I thought he was going to come out in his polar bear outfit.
Yeah. Wrong show. Maybe Company XIV.
Yeah.
True. So, you know, you've seen so much circus and the development of circus in uh-huh. the U.S. Do you feel like it's in a healthy position at the moment? Is it growing? Is it contracting? How would you describe the state?
Well, of course, the big shows like Ringling and all and Big Apple have been having trouble. On the other hand, there's huge burgeoning interest in circus mm-hmm. From your generation. And I find that wonderful. And the schools in Montreal and Quebec and France. Less knowledge about it here, but lots of interest, you know. I mean, but there's no state support, of course. There's no, you know. Las Vegas is turning out to be the place.
It really is. You know, there was a circus panel yesterday at SUNY, and I didn't have time to ask this question, but I'll ask it to mm-hmm. you. Do you think it's more important to have government funding or to have really successful companies? Because, for example, they're sort of talking about, oh, Montreal's so great because you get all this government funding. And I'm like, but is it great because Cirque du Soleil was such a success that then they give, like, extra funding and Cirque also supports all this network of people there? Like,
right.
Is
but
it
the Quebec
chicken
government,
or egg kind yeah, of?
The Quebec government seeded Cirque du Soleil. They gave him $1 million out of nowhere. He was a street performer. Now, you imagine someone
oh
in the United
God.
States doing that.
I wish they would do that for us.
Yeah, nobody would do that here.
No.
And I think... yes, I think there should be government support for the arts more than we have. There should be an acknowledgement that it's really crucial to our lives. Of course, circus is another, that's a whole other step is whether it will ever be considered an art form, but by something like government funding.
Right. I guess
the trouble with the corporate is, to me, they want a branding. They want a certain, I mean, it's individuals who create, you know, or get together with other individuals mm-hmm. and make wild things in their brain, not because they're necessarily going to appeal to, I don't know, Disney or whatever other corporation, you know. So that would be my concern, is that they're not interested in innovation so much.
Mm.
And that if the state funds, you know, a certain number of individuals, see what happens with that. That may be more likely to mm-hmm. be unusual, more unusual developments that you hadn't expected.
Sure. It's a very, you know, it's seeing also like in France, for example, where there is a lot of government funding, yeah. then you do get that, but you get on the flip side fluff, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
It,
yeah, it's true. And you know, in the Soviet Union before the collapse, there was everybody expected to have lifetime jobs, mm-hmm. you know, and that made for a lot of, you know, extra people that they were just expected, no matter how hard they were, they didn't need to work hard because they had a job for life.
Mm-hmm.
So it has its pluses and minuses, but I think There might be a happy medium.
I hope. Yeah. I think there must be a happy medium.
Well, I was just talking about, I came from a meeting earlier that with the head of the board of this nonprofit I'm on the board of, named New Dramatists, and, it's an amazing organization. Yeah. But we were talking about this at this time because he was a CPA during like the 70s when it was like nonprofits popping up every day, mm-hmm. and it was so easy to get funding. Mm-hmm. And from that came like MTC and Roundabout and all these wonderful theaters like Atlantic, mm-hmm. and you know, that came from that time and then prevailed. Mm-hmm. And because I was actually having this conversation with him, I was like, but you know, a lot of funding also creates a lot of not so great stuff.
Yeah.
And he was like, yes, but the great rise to the top and then are there, mm-hmm. and at least they've gotten the chance to rise. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's a good point, because if you don't even get the chance, yeah. how is anyone going to, especially in the US, because it's hard to do commercial and nonprofit. So like, right. what's the...
Yeah, it is interesting because the nonprofit also has a negative, which is a board of directors and, yeah. you know, and the whole complicated fact that they actually control it.
Yeah, and can kick you, the founder, out.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a...
which has happened a few times.
A few times, yeah. Yeah. I don't have an idea what's the better way to go.
No, me either.
Randy says it's easier to raise money from investors than to raise money as a nonprofit.
This is not money you're raising.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. I don't know anything about that. So
I think so too, because actually I was talking about this as well, because I think at least when you raise it from investors, there's the idea that you'll make your money back, uh-huh. versus asking individuals year after year to continue to make grand donation that they'll never see.
Right.
You know, and at least with a commercial venture, you're supporting the art in the same way that you would be a nonprofit, mm. because you still probably will lose most of that money. But there's the chance that you'll get it back, and you're investing most of the time once to create the show that could run year after year after year. Right. So, but I also, you know, tend to have more of a commercial mind, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but I do think that I understand what Randy's saying, because I think that
you know, in America, I think that's definitely,
well, being, you know, working for nonprofits and being on the board, it is hard. It's like, well, how do we find these new donors? Like, how do we find this new big gift?
And nonprofits naturally want to grow. It's like, that's the whole idea. We got to get bigger. Right. What can we do this year better than last year?
And well, actors get more expensive. This is, I mean, as an actor, you might not agree with me, but the off-Broadway community or theaters are having a really hard time raising the gap of the budget this year because Equity raised the minimum weekly salary for actors, which is a wonderful thing. But the nonprofit theaters don't have more seats, like the small ones, not the nonprofits that have Broadway houses.
Right. But so they do tend to get larger and larger administrative staff.
Yes. Also true.
But the plays, unless you want to do a 2 or 3-hander play, mm-hmm. the play itself, every single play almost needs an enhancement from a commercial producer to bridge the gap.
Right.
And it seems like a lot of the theaters are having problems because some are like 75 seats, but the weekly actor salary is more than you could ever make in, you know, if it's a larger cast. Mm. And
I haven't noticed that off-Broadway salaries are very high.
They're not very high, but I think they change like $200. And if it's a cast of...
But for an adult with a family, $200 a week is a little hard to live on.
Yeah.
They're not getting paid $200. They're getting paid for...
Oh, it's like a $750 with their benefits for the union. Yeah. And still, it's not a ton.
I have two kids on the limit, but without that, you know, there's insurance. There didn't used to be anything.
No, yeah, there is insurance now. And I think
the union is what keeps a lot of people going.
Yes. But we need to be able to produce the shows to pay the actors to have work. This is a good argument. It's great because I haven't been able to talk to someone who is an actor on this side of it, you know?
Yeah, a union member.
Yes, a union.
Proud union member.
Yes. Proud union member.
I'm a SAG member. I have to pay my dues. I just realized.
Ah, there you go.
Soon
to be a lap.
I get all my free screeners. What? Soon to be a lap. I know. I got called. But
So are there any, you know, now that you've had the chance to really work in so many different important American circus companies, is there any circuses or shows that are on your bucket list that you really want to work on or create or do?
Well, always have ideas for shows. That's more, it's more like, here's a show we'd like to do. It's not necessarily the organization I would do it for so much as doing, I like to have I find it hard to do a show without a reason to do a show, you know, that something that I think is important that show is. In our time, of course, it's that we in circus work together, a whole lot of people from very diverse backgrounds who don't necessarily agree with each other, all work really hard to make something happen, you know, from the people who put up the tent, you know, to the people selling concessions, to the performers, to the grooms, you know, it's like, and the animals. I mean, that's, animals love to, the animals who are good performers love to perform. They know what they're doing. And some are not so good at it. And they usually don't stay in the show. But anyway, I think that is something that circus has to offer our society and say, we can. You know, we don't have to splinter apart over age, gender, economics, politics. We don't have to do that. And that's what popular theater means to me. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think it's what it meant at the beginning, you know, that people coming together, enjoying something together is in itself a political statement these days.
Yeah, I know. Well, did you see Ellen DeGeneres was sitting and laughing with George Bush and people were giving her such hate? Mm-hmm. And she was like, when I say that you love each other and respect each other, it also goes for people that you don't agree with.
Yes.
And I think it's so crazy when people are like, well, I can't go to that. I can't support that because I don't agree with their views. Mm-hmm. And you say that circus does feel like such a communal experience when you watch it, because you can make noise, you can get up and walk around, you can cheer when you see something that's looking good, not like sitting. And I mean, I love theater, but there is something different when you have like a candy wrapper and someone's
you unwrap your candies
and then people are like you know, and like the laser pointers with the phones and you know. I mean, it is.
No, it's a freedom. Mm-hmm. Did you ever go to the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville?
No,
but I really
do. It's wonderful.
Yes.
I grew up going to it. And it is the same thing of like, you know, something for everybody. And during the radio breaks, there's yo-yo tricks. And, you know, it's just like this so wonderful atmosphere. Nobody stays still. Everybody's wandering around. And yet it's fun for people, you know, all different kinds of people. They have something about it that appeals to them. And that's what a circus has, I think.
Oh, I think so, too. And there's something magical about a tent.
Yeah.
It's just you can.
Yeah.
You walk in, it's just like, wow, I'm in a tent.
Yeah. They're wonderful. And a lot of work to maintain and expensive.
So expensive.
Yeah.
Josh did his thesis on touring a tent in the U.S.
Oh, really?
Why it's not so practical. Well,
definitely the trucks.
Yes. Well, the thesis that I wrote was, how come is it possible for plays and musicals to go out in tents and build a tent touring network? And the answer in America is not really.
No. Because it was like, you know, Cats did a tented tour that actually Ross Mollison worked on. Mm-hmm. And it didn't go well.
It was challenged.
Because of the expense of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Putting the tent up and down.
Yeah.
And they bought a custom tent that had the cat's eyes on it. And there's just not the infrastructure. And America's a very big country. It's not like Switzerland or France where you can go 15 miles.
Right. You have to go long, long distances. And then restrictions on where you can put up a tent. There's many more restrictions.
And real estate's much more expensive now than it was.
Much more.
Even just sound
leak
and rules. Mm-hmm. You know, you like, you can't make sound after this. And you end in a tent, it's...
Yeah.
Canvas, you're like, I can't really control it, you know? So just makes it hard and harder.
It might swing back, we'll see.
I hope so. It's like the pendulum, right?
Yeah,
it might, because it certainly used to be like religious revivals were intense.
Yeah.
You know, there was all
the term for like
all over the country.
Sort of like educational programming that would come through in tents that was like a mix of speakers. What's the term for that?
That's right. What is that? Inspirational.
Yeah. Also turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century.
Especially in the Midwest.
I exactly.
My family used to go to those things.
Well, somebody write in who's smarter than us. We wrap up every episode by asking our guests the same three questions.
Oh, okay.
The first of which is, has there been a piece of advice, either really good or really terrible, that somebody has given to you that stuck with you?
Gosh, I don't think I have any such thing. The one thing I remember when I first directed was an older European man who really didn't want to be taking orders from a woman saying to me, "Are you asking me or are you telling me?" And which was very difficult for me to not say, "Would you?" or
right.
"Could you?" or, you know.
Right. I was just wondering.
So I finally said, "I'm telling you." So that for me was, yeah, it's always stuck with me, that challenge. Is, yeah.
Yes, I'm telling you. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. This one I feel like should probably be kind of easy for you since you've taught so many people. But for our younger listeners who mm-hmm. want to become a circus performer or right. actor or just get into right. the arts, is there a book, movie, show, just a reference that you would recommend they check out?
Well, I mean, Javi did a book on circus techniques, which is fairly clear in terms of learning things or, you know, beginning things, which is probably good. There's a Pickle Family Circus book with lots of photos of that era from Terry Laurent.
Yeah. I think we have it on our shelf. It's a yellow book.
Yeah, it's a yellow book, right. It's quite a yellow book. I would just, then there's all kinds of books from over the last 150 years about circus in America, and to not feel there is no history here, there's a huge amount. It's just gotten sort of neglected.
Yes.
And circuses were touring all over, like when we were talking about, like Peru, Indiana was the home of a lot of circuses. When you go there, you can still see the rhinoceros barn, you know, stuff like that, and it disappeared. But, so knowing some of that, I think, it's fun and inspiring in the sense, like, you don't have to go far away.
Right.
You
know? Yes.
Yeah, the American circus history is harder to read about, but we've learned so much about it through doing this podcast.
I bet you have. Yeah.
So much.
Yeah.
Part of me wants to like listen back to everything and write it all down. And you're like, oh, this is the timeline. And so many people's paths crossed and, you know, interesting ways. And this whole kind of like the nonprofit in New York time, it was like this circus scene in America with all your generation of people, which was like just so, the Pickle Family.
And for us, from before us, was the vaudeville people who were still alive.
Right.
And they were very generous.
Well, I guess this is a good question to ask because maybe you'll suggest one of them. Who's a good person to have on our podcast?
You seem to have had a lot of people.
We have a lot of people.
Yeah, the question gets harder.
I know it does.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you talked to Anouk?
No.
Yeah, Anouk's a good person. And Laura Balding is an interesting person. Mm. She's an animal trainer person.
Mm-hmm.
Is she David Balding's
wife?
Wife. Wife.
Yeah. Katja Schumann?
No.
Oh, she is great. She's in Denmark, so you'd have to, but she comes over here.
We can Skype.
She comes over here, and the Schumanns were a Danish circus family, very well known. And she came and here with her horses, she's great, and married Paul Binder.
Oh.
And they have two kids who are.
How did I not know Paul's?
Yeah, okay. So her name is Katja Schumann.
Okay.
And she's extraordinarily smart circus person.
Okay.
Great research.
I'm sure she was in because Paul was also on our podcast. He was actually, it was interesting because he was on our podcast right when Big Apple was trying to get that last push of donations before going into bankruptcy. Okay. And it was an interesting time for him, obviously, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of want to have him back on now that it's gone through this whole thing.
He said he's moving to Florida in 2 weeks. So
did he?
But I'm sure he'll be back.
I know. I'm like, he'll be back.
Those are all the great circus, you know, people have to end up at some point.
Yeah,
Florida's a great state to retire to.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
And that was our interview with Cecil McKinnon.
If you like our podcast, make sure to rate us on iTunes, follow us on iTunes, Twitter tweet us, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
And get tickets to our shows, Beyond Babel. You can get those tickets on beyondbabelshow.com. That show's in New York City. And our show in Las Vegas, The Misbehave Game Show. Tickets are available at themisbehavegameshow.com.
Have a good week. Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.